Part 1. Predator and Prey.
Forrest. When Forrest gave the reason for his visit, the sergeant's face darkened as he reached for a folder on his desk. "Anyone ever tell you," he said as he handed over papers, "you slick lawyers are no better than the scumbags you get off. How do you guys manage to sleep at night?" In response, Forrest just nodded, saying nothing of his insomnia and his own feelings that were mirrored in the policeman's eyes. 40 minutes later, hostility palpable in the room, he left the station with his client, a smirking Jose Mara, known drug runner from somewhere south of the border. 2 overzealous rookies on the force, one handy with his computer and a scanner, had doctored an old warrant. Close scrutiny by Forrest's assistant and 2 phone calls had revealed the bogus warrant for what it was. Presented with the evidence at the arraignment, the judge had little choice but to dismiss, despite more than just traces of cocaine that the 2 young cops had found in Mara's toilet. On his way back to his office, $12,000 of Mara's dirty money in his blazer pocket, he felt less than charitable toward criminal attorneys like himself, who rationalize all they did in the holy context of due process. Intolerable as were forged documents by the police, his client deserved to be in prison, not on the street. Had his 5-digit attorney's fee not guaranteed scrutiny of every angle, that was exactly where Mara would be, getting acquainted with other inmates at Santa Lucia's Cabrillo County Jail, known locally as CO. With one hand on her keyboard and the other on the phone, Marta looked up as he walked in. It was just past 3. Her eyes were red-rimmed and tears still stained her face. His secretary and good friend for more than 10 years, he was not overly alarmed by what he saw. She was normally cheerful and always efficient, but one call from a relative in distress and the emotional side of Marta would be showing. About to ask her what was wrong, she sorrowfully shook her head and motioned toward Ben's office. Trouble between those 2 again? He very much hoped not. Their tolerance for each other was at an all-time low. He walked over to Ben's door and tapped. Something was very definitely amiss. The room was so dense with smoke that his eyes were burning as he sat down. The only time Ben's cigarettes came out was when he was thoroughly upset. In the 8 years they'd worked together, he could not remember this occurring more than 2. Through the haze, Forrest regarded him. Benjamin Sigalowitz had to be close to 50, a veteran detective with the NYPD who decided to set up business for himself out west. He'd come to work with Forrest shortly after. The arrangement had worked out well, Ben with his own clients as a PI and available to Forrest when he needed him. Nearly bald with closely cropped gray hair along the sides, Ben's face was chiseled, with little attention to aesthetics, his nose beaked and over-large, and his mouth a hard, thin line. His dark brown eyes reflected the cynic that he was. He was a first-class investigator who'd become a reliable close friend. At the moment, he looked grim. "You here?" he asked. "Hear what?" Forrest came back. "You ever listen to the news?" Ben said, his tone almost accusing. "Ben, what's going on?" His friend jabbed at a round button on his keyboard, and his computer came to life. "Looks like somebody's nabbed Johnny Parker's daughter." Uncomprehending, Forrest stared at the picture of a friendly-looking little girl with long black hair that would soon figure in newspapers and posters everywhere. Divinity, Detective Johnny Parker's child? It couldn't be. Forrest resisted, the idea too horrific to take in. Not Johnny's little girl who'd played with his own daughter, Trina, at a Christmas party just weeks before. "My God," he heard himself say. "When did it happen? Where, at school?" As Ben responded, the image of Forrest's own 8-year-old little girl merged in his mind with the picture on the screen. He shivered. "No sign of her when the kids came in playing after lunch. For now, that's all I've got, and," sighing deeply, "all I'm likely to get for quite a while." Believing what Ben had told him, yet wanting it not to be, he rephrased what he had heard. Disappeared from the playground. Just like that.
So it would seem.
Crusty and unemotional as he was, one of Ben's few soft spots was children. The change in him when interacting with Forrest's Trina and twin brother Andy was remarkable. Does Marta know about this? He asked.
Hell yes. She's been bawling about it for seems like hours.
His mind still reeling from what was very probably an abduction, he failed to catch Ben's abrupt change of tack.
I said, did you spring that sleaze bag, Mara?
Yeah, Ben, I did.
The boys downtown who fiddled the warrant been a little more careful, our Jose would be sweating it for a while. Did the bugger pay up?
Forrest nodded absently, his thoughts on what he and Claire could do to help firm up security at their children's school. In his own office, Forrest gazed at Trina's picture, his stomach in knots. Masses of lustrous dark brown hair, down to her shoulders, framed a small oval face, the most notable feature her green eyes. Although she might never be a standout beauty, the nose a bit long and the chin a trifle underdefined, to him she was exquisite. Each time he looked at her, he felt tenderness and love he would not have believed possible before her birth. Irrational as he knew it to be, he felt real fear. Who in God's name could have taken little Divinity Parker? Too much to hope that the abductors were just people desperate to have a child of their own. No, he mouthed, a chill moving up and down his spine. A girl of that age? No, he whispered to himself. More like trafficking or something worse. With a sense of foreboding, he reached for the intercom that was flashing. Mr. Spencer, came Marta's disgruntled voice. Martin Cooper's here. He insists he needs to see you right away. I told him it was late and he doesn't have an appointment, but what can I say? She was doing little to hide her dislike for his most recent client, a cantankerous little man whom she found obnoxious and condescending. Forrest's need at that moment was to be home. He told Marta that he would be leaving and to arrange something later with his new client. Their raised voices reached him as he gathered up his things. Claire was home earlier than usual. Lupe, their all-but-live-in sitter, was leaving as he pulled in. From the sound of Andy's whooping and the smells issuing from the kitchen, Claire must have picked up Chinese. A pediatric surgeon at Socorro, his wife's hours weren't her own. She was home sometimes by 6, too frequently at hours well past 10. At that moment, she looked harassed, in no mood for Andy's clowning. Forrest waved at the twins as he entered the spacious, ceramic-tiled kitchen, Claire's sole concession to modernity in their sumptuous, Spanish-style home. She turned to speak to him, glanced briefly at the children, then changed her mind. Claire had to have heard of Divinity Parker's disappearance, she unwilling as was he to discuss the matter before the kids.
Chinese, Chinese, Chinese,
piped Andy, bouncing impatiently in his chair.
Piggy, piggy, piggy,
taunted Trina, making shoveling motions toward her mouth. Enough, Claire scolded. You keep that up, you two. I'll send you to your rooms. Claire was decidedly upset. She rarely sharp-voiced with the twins. He'd find out later why. It would have been a newscast she'd heard on her way home or some problem at Socorro. It would ferment for a while, then come out all at once, probably just before they were heading off to bed. Her turn for supervising baths and reading stories, Claire followed two dawdlers up the stairs and to their rooms while he cleaned up. Lines from Charlotte's Web drifted down to him as he poured an after-dinner glass of port and settled in the one chair in the room that he found comfortable, a black leather recliner that Claire despised. Like her mother, from whom their home had been inherited, she liked antiques. The more fragile and non-functional, the better, it seemed to him. Walls and fireplace, all of white plaster, contrasted with wood-beamed ceiling and dark hardwood floor. The room was almost too busy with memorabilia from trips to Africa and Asia that he and Claire had taken before the birth of their two children. And, not to be overlooked, small paintings and tapestries nearly everywhere he looked, some beautiful, but too numerous for him. He preferred the simplicity of his study and functional gleaming kitchen, the one for work and the other for cooking, his source of relaxation. But it was the room that she had known from childhood, so reminiscent of her much-loved mother's tastes, that Claire preferred when communing with him in the evening. Still too early for the 10 o'clock news. Even then, they were unlikely to learn anything of substance unless Divinity had been found. But had that happened, Ben would most certainly have called. He reached for the morning paper for the news, aware that nothing on the abduction would yet be there. He looked up as Claire's footsteps resounded in the front hall. Her face was set as she sat down in a wooden armchair that looked ready to collapse. Despite the no-nonsense way she wore her dark blonde hair and the angularity of her face, she turned heads. Ample, high-placed breasts pulled focus away from her slim and thin-hipped body. At the moment, her gray eyes reflected the set expression on her wide mouth. Compared with her, everything about him, as he saw it, was nondescript. He of average height and medium build, and brown hair that at the temples was already going gray. On a good day, women might say that he had a friendly face, and they liked his warm brown eyes. "You know about Lieutenant Parker's little girl," she said, her voice a little brusque. "Yeah, my love, I do. You hear it on the news?" "Yes, on my way home. Forrest, are we okay? Could such a thing happen at our school?" Even though Claire was not of an excitable disposition, he thought before he answered. "It could happen anywhere, I imagine. We'll have to talk to the principal to find out what procedures they have in place." "Why," she groused, "does something bad always have to happen before people react?" He agreed to call the school early next morning for an appointment. Claire, it was obvious, had other things on her mind. He did what he had learned best to do, just wait. Reproachfully, she said, "How long are we going to continue to support the drug trade?" About to ask her what she was going on about, he saw her right hand pull something from beneath her right thigh, then wave at him. It could be nothing but Mara's money in his blazer pocket that he'd neglected to deposit. He'd forgotten that he'd asked Claire to put that blazer in the dry clean pile. Large sums that she had found in his pockets before were almost always cash payments by clients who preferred not to leave paper trails. "I know where this money comes from. I refuse to buy my children's food with this." "Claire," both resignation and defiance in his tone, "we've been over this how many times before? Criminal lawyers like me aren't there to make decisions about who's innocent and who's guilty. You know this." In answer, she stood up abruptly, tossed the packet of $100 bills in his lap, and stalked off. Sighing, he walked to the closet and put the money where it had been before, the blazer still there, then went back to his recliner. He'd wait there for 30 minutes to catch the news. He brooded about what she'd said. It rankled him that his wife should think it fair to pass judgment on how he conducted his profession, while dismissing anything he might say about how she handled hers. Might it not be possible, for instance, to rearrange her hours so that she could be home more often on the weekends to be with the family? Her indignant reply, "Was Forrest so obtuse to think that parents knew when their children would be injured or got sick?" He hadn't re-raised the issue. My God, he thought as he downed his drink, the sanctitude of physicians in the U.S. But, to be fair, he conceded as he refilled his glass, she had a point. The more successful he'd become in his career, the more bona fide villains he had for clients. How many desperate, addicted people, he pondered, had contributed to his fees? Tainted Mara's money was as Claire had rightly said. He believed in the principle that every accused person was entitled to a fair hearing, but he'd grown weary of getting too many guilty people off. As close to the far side of their bed as she could be, Claire would be impervious to any conciliatory gesture he might make. Forrest lay, unable to sleep, thinking about the woman he had married and still loved, about how insular she was at times. His thoughts shifted to the Parkers and their daughter. After 20 minutes of journalistic pap, he'd switched the television off. Johnny and Gracie had looked appalling, each heartbreakingly appealing to whomever might have their baby to bring her back. How would he himself have coped had the missing child been his? The idea was too shattering to consider. Finally, he slept.